Hey, this is Robert Stark. I'd like to introduce our guest for today. His name is Bay Area Guy. And as you know, our last show, we interviewed Dota. And Dota and Bay Area Guy, they have a blog. It's called Occident Invicta, the Unconquered West. Hey, Bay Area Guy, it's nice having you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Obviously, you're from the San Francisco Bay Area.
That is correct. We are both fellow Californians. I lived most of my life in the East Bay, and now I'm living in the Peninsula, so I've kind of seen the Bay Area in all its glory and all its diversity.
So I guess what I'll ask you to start off with is I want to talk about your background, how that influenced your views. But let's start off with your website is called Occident Invicta. Dota is your co-blogger, but you were the one who really came up with the idea to start the site.
Well, I've always had a passion for history and ideas, and I actually met Dota commenting on Robert Lindsay's blog years ago. You know Robert Lindsay.
I had dinner with him in Fresno, California several weeks ago.
Oh yeah, he says he lives in some kind of middle of the nowhere, central California type of town.
Yeah, it does.
But yeah, anyway, Dota and I, we met on Robert Lindsay's blog. We both shared a similar passion for ideas, for history, for defense of the West. But, and this is no disrespect to Robert Lindsay, but his blog eventually started to become a little bit overrun with trolls and a lot of the quality commenters were leaving. And so, you know what, I figured to myself, it's time to actually maybe start my own blog where I can better articulate my ideas and where I can run the show on my own.
So,
and,
yeah.
I feel we've accomplished a decent amount considering we've only been at it for half a year.
So you can talk about your personal background being from the Bay Area. How did that influence your views?
Well, I think the great paradox in my life is that my proximity and my exposure to diversity has actually made me more skeptical of it. Like I said, I mostly lived in the East Bay for much of my life. I attended a private middle school, which had a substantial black population. I then attended a rather diverse high school where it was sort of a United Nations racial friend group I was represented in. There was one Latino. I was the token white guy. And in many ways, being the white minority kind of heightened my racial consciousness. And it made me question many fundamental assumptions, because throughout my life, I grew up on the narrative of the civil rights movement, slavery, the Emancipation Proclamation, imperialism, colonialism, apartheid South Africa. I was just had this narrative drilled into my head that as a white male, I was this horrible, hegemonic oppressor who always devised new ways to inflict harm upon non-white people.
So you were going around in your high school inflicting harm on all the diverse people there.
Yeah, I mean, they had to send me to sensitivity training every week. But anyway,
was that in Oakland?
No, that was actually in the Peninsula, where I'm actually currently living right now, because my dad teaches there, and so I went to school there for high school. And high school is really what shaped my consciousness ultimately, because despite being told of how powerful, privileged, and hegemonic I was, I often found that, at least in day-to-day social interactions, especially within various social groups, that being white in many ways was not seen as being too cool. It was seen as being sort of oppressive. People could make fun of you, but you weren't allowed to make fun of them back. You were constantly demonized and harangued. And I just remember thinking to myself, if whites are really so hegemonic, powerful, and oppressive, why is it that we're constantly being demonized, harangued, and put in check by those who are supposedly weak and powerless? It just didn't really make much sense to me. And then I looked up recent demographic trends regarding the impending minority status of whites. I looked at growing political trends. I came of age during the first presidential campaign of Barack Obama, so I could never really buy into the liberal narrative of, you know, irredeemable white supremacy. It just never made sense to me based on my own experience.
And Yeah, you get into a lot of this. You have an article, the racial dynamics of the Bay Area.
Oh, yeah. And one of the commenters asked me to elaborate on it. And I think my own experiences in the Bay Area can actually be quite instructive, because if you listen to some of these alternative right, dark enlightenment, or white nationalist types, sometimes you get the impression that the left is this omnipotent force and that whites are forever on the retreat and that, you know, there's this menacing rainbow coalition that will one day undermine white people completely.
But no, but you're saying those groups, within those groups, a lot of them, they have their own grievances against each other.
Oh, exactly. Well, not necessarily grievances, but anyone who thinks that there's some sort of monolithic people of color coalition, well, they'd be disabused of that notion if they actually observed sort of the diverse groups in the Bay Area. I've actually heard the most politically incorrect and racist jokes from primarily non-white people. Like when I'm in my group of non-white friends, I can tell whatever jokes I like. It's when I'm around these predominantly white liberal groups that I've gotten in trouble. It's kind of ironic, actually. So, and I just, as I pointed out in that article, I think that at some point something's going to have to give, because the interests of a white liberal feminist woman versus more of a working class Latino man, and then Asians are a rising power in the Bay Area. You look at the two major cities such as Oakland and SF, and they both have Asian mayors currently. And I just don't think that this people of color coalition will remain firm. And it's not even very firm to begin with. Especially as whites continue to dwindle in number and influence, what's going to be the glue that holds these groups together when the big bad white man goes down?
Yeah, I think it will, those groups will break up. So, yeah, all these people are pessimistic and they think it's us versus them, but it's a lot more complex than that.
And that's what I pointed out in my post, too. A lot of people, especially if you read certain white nationalist blogs, you often have sort of this binary conception of race relations where it's white versus black or white versus some interchangeable brown mass. But if you look at the Bay Area, you have to think of race a lot more broadly. It's white, it's yellow, it's brown, it's beige, it's a lot of things. So in many ways, what the Bay Area also illustrates is that just because old identities break down doesn't mean it's going to usher in some harmonious racial utopia. New divisions will arise, and some of the most politically incorrect and inappropriate people I've met have actually been of mixed race extraction.
Yeah, yeah. So how would you explain, could you explain the different parts of the Bay Area and how they compare? Like, there's San Francisco, there's the Silicon Valley, there's East Bay, and then there's the North Bay.
Well, I can't speak on every single area of the Bay Area, but I have lived on both sides, and I think you can divide the Bay Area into the East Bay. I'd say the East Bay features the most abundant diversity. In Oakland, it has a heavy black population, but increasingly, Latinos and Asians are also beginning to gain political clout. I believe that Oakland even has an Asian mayor as we speak. And if you go to other parts of the East Bay, like the Richmond, El Cerrito area, you kind of have a mixture of black and Asian. It's a little more lower middle class. If you go to SF, obviously it's mostly, well, whites are the plurality there. And then you also have an increasingly influential and growing Asian population, especially the Chinese. Ed Lee, a Chinese American guy, is currently the mayor there. So yeah, and then it has a minor Latino population. Where I'm currently living is in San Mateo County, which is one of the more affluent areas of the Bay Area, if not the entire country. And it has its own mixture of diversity, predominantly white, but then also substantial Asian and even Latino populations. So the only white-topias I can think of in the Bay Area are perhaps, say, Marin County, places like Hillsboro, but yeah, diversity is omnipresent here.
So you were pointing out, using people that you've known who have been mixed race, you're saying they've been less politically correct than just regular white people.
Absolutely. And I think it's because they don't have any white guilt to hinder their politically incorrect jokes. Because, well, since they can invoke their non-white status, well, They have no need to feel guilt. Their attitude is, I can just say what I want. I'm not white. The most politically correct, self-righteous people have always been within white circles. I remember this time when I went to a social gathering, and there was this group of white girls talking, and one of them was going on about how she attended college somewhere in the Southwest, and she's like, oh, I can't go to this school, it's too white. And of course, she was completely blind to the irony that she's saying this in a group of all white girls, not a single face of color in sight. And I've always found that really fascinating. The white people who seem to be the most self-righteous and who embrace diversity, there always seems to be a significant dearth of diversity within their own social circles.
And your personal diversity is, you're half Nordic and half Greek. Do you see a difference between the, would you say Nordics are definitely a lot more politically correct than, say, the Greek side of your background?
Well, the Greek side of my background lives more in a Republican Midwestern part of the country, so I think that accounts for their less liberal views than their Greek background.
So are they Golden Dawn supporters?
Yeah, they better report them to the authorities. But, yeah. Well, I've never really distinguished much between Nordic and, say, Mediterranean. Because honestly, when the average Latino, Asian, or Black person sees me on the street, are they going to say to themselves, oh, Greek American, or, ooh, no, Germanic? No, they're just going to see me as another white boy. So I just identify as a white person. And that's another thing I actually wanted to talk about. One of the posts I wrote was on the whole idea that race is just a social construct. If you read the left enough, you'll always hear this trope thrown out, so-and-so identity is just a social construct, so it should be abolished. But as I point out, just because an identity is a social construct doesn't render it any less worthy of defending, doesn't make it invalid. Because if you go back in world history, just about every identity was socially constructed at some point. And yet only with white people does its social construction render it indefensible or in need of being abolished. You know, I look like a white person. I was raised with white Western cultural values. So, you know, I don't care if I'm a social construct. I'm still a white person, and I don't need to invoke HBD or some kind of genetic argument to justify that.
So, even if it is a social construct does not have to be this horrific thing that needs to be destroyed.
Absolutely not.
I mean, the nation, you could say a nation state or a religion is a social construct. A culture is
even
a social construct.
Liberals love to fawn over. In fact, if you even go within certain liberal circles, you'll often hear the word culture used as a proxy for race. Like after I took the LSAT one year, I was sitting and I heard this girl talking to a guy. She was telling him how he could try to appeal to the administrators based on his diversity. And she said, oh, and not just in terms of cultural diversity, but other things. And of course, right away, I knew that she meant culture as race. I find it funny how so many Americans are just terrified of using the dreaded R word. It's like they think that we're all just some interchangeable mass.
And you have this post, the Wimpy Whites Test.
Oh, yeah. It's more of a humorous, tongue-in-cheek post. Me and Dota actually co-authored it together. Some of the questions are his, some of them are mine.
And I passed it, but I look over it. I look over a few of them, maybe. I mean, trees are nice. I mean, I like forests, so maybe. but you do have to cut down trees, I guess. But I like forests. But I passed most of them. I got them right.
All right, I guess you get the normal heterosexual male score then, as opposed to the awakening wimpiness. But yeah, a lot of the questions are sort of meant to be tongue-in-cheek, sort of draw on pop culture, and sort of just poke fun. And I think that's something that's missing within many white nationalist and alternative right movements.
Yeah, there's so many people. They take them, a lot of guys who are so, they're angry or they take themselves so seriously.
Yeah. And I think that partially if you want to construct a winning movement, then you have to convey the proper confidence, the proper winning attitude. And I think that white nationalists could actually borrow from another element of the alternative right or dark enlightenment, the manosphere, for example. Oh, yeah. I mean, the Manosphere definitely has a lot of articles complaining about hypergamy or whatnot. But at the same time, they also feature a lot of very empowering articles, articles on how to improve yourself, articles on how to work out. And I think white nationalists could borrow from that. They could have articles on more humorous articles, articles on how to successfully serve as an activist. I just feel like, you know, saying that, oh no, those intelligent Jews are subverting everything. They're too smart for us. What are we going to do? I just feel like I want to take this blog in a new in a sort of a different direction. One that
that's a topic we could start off with the Manosphere, but you have within the Manosphere, I guess there is it starts off with the whole pessimistic kind of angry, bitter thing.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's definitely going to be a lot of anger present within these alternative right movements because, you know, to find out that you've been lied to your whole life and that society's basically full of shit.
And that's the first step. Once you discover these things, you go through a phase where you're really, where people are angry and bitter.
Oh yeah, and it's definitely understandable to go through the phase, but at some point you also need to channel that anger into something more constructive. And I feel like, you know, white nationalists could use a little more humor. They could use a little more practical articles. I feel like the problems are definitely well articulated and the problems they denounce can't really be disputed. But at the same time, I come away feeling somewhat helpless reading those articles like, oh no, the system's too entrenched. It's too corrupt. It's too decadent. What can we do? And I feel like there are steps that can be taken to help sort of weaken, well, what Dark Enlightenment types would call the cathedral. And I actually sort of articulated that in one of my latest posts when talking about, oh man, Justin Bieber, the whole petition surrounding him where they wanted President Obama to deport him. And I mean, aside from the fact that it's ridiculous that they're asking the commander-in-chief.
And Dota has to live with the shame of having him as a countryman. Well, or he could, he could say he's not a real, he could say he's from India, so he's not really Canadian, but if he's a Canadian, you have to live with that embarrassment.
Yeah, I'm just glad he's not American. He's someone else's cross to bear.
But he's emulating, the thing about it is he grows up in Canada, but he's emulating the worst of America.
Oh yeah. I mean, if you look at cities such as Toronto or other places near the U.S., you can't, in terms of the obesity, the attitudes, the social media addiction, it is a lot like the United States. And in many ways, the world is becoming more Americanized, but not in the greatest of ways. But anyway, going back to Bieber, what I wrote near the end of the post was, for all these people complaining about how we need to get rid of Justin Bieber, he's a bad influence on our society, my attitude is, you know, simply starve the beast. Don't consume pop culture, don't consume celebrity gossip, don't stay on Facebook all the time, you know, do something else instead. If enough people get together and say, enough is enough, we're not going to indulge this any longer, then I think it could be undermined, and I think real change could be made.
And that goes, I look at your article, the corporations behind cultural crimes, and are the show, you didn't get to hear the interview live I did of Dota, but you'll hear it when it's archived. And we touched a little bit on the issue of corporations, but you have a lot of these topics. You have obesity, mass immigration, feminism, all these issues, and you talk about the corporate role behind all these things.
Well, I think once you interviewed Matt Forney, and one of the main criticisms he had of the alternative right was that it didn't have enough of a focus on economics.
And which interview was that? Are you talking about the one I did about the...
I believe the one about the managerial revolution.
Yeah, I did two of them. One about the managerial revolution and one about Mark Ames, yeah.
And I think he made an excellent point because as much as these feminists, these multiculturalists, and these other petulant left-wing activists like to proclaim their strength and independence, as I point out in my article, the truth of the matter is that none of these groups would have achieved nearly as much as they did if not for the support of various white male elites. Big corporations want mass immigration for cheap labor. You know, corporations want to sort of make their workers more docile, and that might account for the feminization of the workplace. I just feel like...
And with feminism, it was a perfect way basically to double the size of the workforce and to quadruple the number of consumers.
Oh, yeah. I once saw an interview, this interview of Aaron Russo and...
Freedom, yeah. Freedom to... The movie Freedom to Fascism.
Yeah, and I don't know how... I mean, he mentioned talking to the Rockefellers, and the Rockefellers said... Well, we supported feminism because we couldn't tax half of the population before. And now with women out of the home, now kids can be indoctrinated more by the state. Now, I don't necessarily like to traffic in conspiracy theories, but if the big corporations opened our borders and basically turned the United States increasingly diverse just for more profits, it's not a radical stretch to suggest that they also supported feminist aims for similar reasons. And therefore, I think that, yeah, I get it. In the manosphere and elsewhere, it's fun to poke fun at these petulant fat feminists like Lindy West. Oh, I get it. It's fun. But ultimately...
But yeah, they're just pawns.
Oh, yeah, they're just pawns. I mean, I think even Roosh on his site Return of Kings pointed out that, you know, by herself, Lindy West wouldn't actually pose any real cultural threat, but she's...
Yeah, I think Matt Forney said the site Jezebel is a part of Gawker, which is one
which
of the big corporations.
Yeah.
What is it owned by?
It's owned by a man, Nick Denton, so even these so-called independent feminists, well, their own feminist site is ultimately owned by a man, so... And that's why I think that we have to focus a little bit more on the top... Because ultimately, a lot of these people, like you said, they're just pawns. And I think there needs to be more awareness of economics and the role that corporate greed plays in actually inflicting cultural Marxism on the rest of us.
Yeah, because we were discussing with Robert Lindsay. And Robert Lindsay is he's obviously like a big socialist. But he has a point, because you know what? I'm actually in favor of taxing the ultra wealthy because it's a way of limiting their power. I think you should tax these billionaires. I think it's a smart idea.
Absolutely. And I always found Robert Lindsay a very fascinating figure, because when I stumbled upon his blog and it said he was a socialist, and then I read all these articles denouncing open borders and criticizing multiculturalism, and I remember sort of pinching myself and saying, is this guy really a leftist? I didn't know that there were leftists who actually opposed open borders or cultural Marxist nonsense. So that's sort of what drew me to his blog in the first place, sort of that interesting mixture of views. And I definitely agree that...
He's not going to like to admit it. He calls himself a leftist, but in a sense he is an extension of the alternative right sphere.
Well, at least on cultural issues such as race, realism, feminism, and whatnot. But in terms of economics, he definitely espouses more progressive views. And I think people on the alternative right should, in general, espouse more progressive economic views, because ultimately, like I said before, these big corporations, these big businesses, are the ones who are ultimately creating all these cultural crimes we complain about. Mass immigration, diversity, feminism, pop culture garbage. If their power could somehow be curbed, then I think that alone would go a long way towards reversing some of these more negative trends.
Were you the one who said that the alternative right, they have to embrace the idea of economic justice?
I said that, yeah, and I think I would say it again, because I feel that ultimately... I also speak, when I say that, as a millennial. If you look at a lot of the older white nationalists, such as, say, Jared Taylor or Kevin MacDonald...
Because they're from an era of prosperity. I mean, I have a lot of respect for those guys.
Oh, and
but
same.
They are economically well off. Like, I know Kevin MacDonald, and he is a great guy, but he is well off economically. I think it's a millennial issue... Because coming up into the world, and we are basically seeing we are screwed economically. The opportunities aren't there. And I don't think that the conservative economic views that we have seen in the past. They're like Reagan, all this stuff, all this garbage like Reaganomics. And the same with, I think Matt, the thing about, you mentioned Matt Forney. He's a millennial as well. He's about, I'm 28 and he's like 25, so we're around the same age. And we basically take this view because we don't see the economic opportunities that there used to be. And I don't think conservative free market economics has the answers.
Oh, it doesn't. And partially the reason why I blog is my goal has always been to reach a more young audience. And, you know, I want to write posts that can resonate with them. And ultimately, if you're a young millennial such as myself, you're not going to be thinking too much about the subversion of the Frankfurt School or, you know, all these old Jewish activist movements. You're going to be thinking about whether or not you can get a job, whether or not you're going to have prosperity. So I feel that I just don't feel like I can. I feel like sometimes Jared Taylor and Kevin McDonald, I also tremendously respect their work, but they did come from a more prosperous era, and I don't feel like their writing really resonates with a younger audience that doesn't have as much time or luxury to really sort of espouse the same kind of views or promote the same kind of activism as them.
Are you familiar with, you're familiar with Countercurrents?
I am.
My show is on Countercurrents, and I interviewed a Greg Johnson on this on the Boomerang Generation, and he was making this point. He's looking for people who are of the millennial generation to talk about these issues like economics. But there's just on he admits this on Countercurrents. There is this lack of writing on economics.
Oh, yeah, and that's definitely a big problem. And granted, it's understandable because, as we've established, a lot of these older white nationalists tend to be baby boomers who grew up in an era of unprecedented prosperity. But ultimately, if they really want to engage young people, they have to write about issues that resonate them. And I think that's partially one of the big reasons why the Manosphere has exploded so tremendously, because it writes about issues that young men really relate to, issues about game, getting laid, working out, finding a career. That's stuff that young people can relate to. They can't
Just race, a lot of the racial stuff, it's kind of abstract. The two things that your average young guy is thinking about is getting laid and making money.
Yeah, they're not thinking too much about Herbert Marcuse and the Frankfurt School, that's for sure. So yeah, I just feel like they need to sort of broaden their message or recruit more young people. And granted, not every white nationalist or paleoconservative is an old fossil. I think James Edwards has his own political cesspool show. He's a little younger, but I do.
And Richard Spencer of Alternative Right, he's probably in his early 30s.
Yeah. But ultimately, I feel like, yeah, there just needs to be more of an outreach to young people. If there is any kind of diversity that I wholeheartedly support, it's that of age and ideology. And I also feel like a lot of these older white nationalists have more libertarian, you know, pseudo-Republican economic views. And as we've been over, you know, for young millennials who have to wait tables after getting a college degree, that's not really going to fly with them.
They're looking. I mean, all these older people, they were probably supporters of Ronald Reagan and the trickle-down economics, but that's just not going to fly. We have to look at economic solutions for the future.
Oh, yeah, the trickle-down has definitely not trickled down.
Yeah, it's trickled to all these people like Sheldon Adelson and George Soros and the Koch brothers. Yeah.
So, yeah, in many ways, as much as it was misguided and as much as it devolved into identity politics, I feel like Occupy Wall Street really did represent this millennial frustration with this never-ending grind, with just sort of this insurmountable economic system. And I feel like white nationalists and others could take a lead in trying to maybe, you know, promote alternatives, because ultimately, if a movement wants to be successful, it needs a viable, thriving middle class. Almost every revolution in history has been supported by this vibrant, thriving middle class. you know, it's not going to be fostered by these unemployed layabouts playing video games all day. So, you know, if you want to create a real viable movement, you need a more productive, more prosperous population.
And what are some specific economic ideas that you're interested in?
Specific economic ideas? Now, don't get me wrong, I am not a pinko commie, God forbid. But I do believe in progressive taxation. From a practical standpoint, I don't see why the filthy rich should be able to retain their enormous amount of wealth. I'm also against globalization and outsourcing. I do believe in some measure of protectionism. I want to revitalize local American industries. And of course, as part of my, in addition to economic reasons, I'm also definitely against mass immigration. And what I always found ironic is that so-called liberals and progressives will always march lockstep with these big corporations and supporting mass immigration, never realizing that they're in fact these useful idiots.
Yeah, I mean, I think a good way I think a good idea would be to combine like the best ideas of Pat Buchanan with the best ideas of say Ralph Nader.
Yeah, and you know, it's actually funny because I remember reading an editorial by Ralph Nader called "How About Some Corporate Patriotism for a Change?" And late in the article, he even cites Pat Buchanan when he says, you know, this struggle against corporations is not a left or a right issue. It's an American issue, as even Pat Buchanan agrees with me. So, I don't know. I've never really dogmatically adhered to any liberal or conservative label, although I'm obviously against many nutty manifestations of liberalism. But ultimately, I speak as a millennial. I speak as a white person. And I try to combine a wide variety of views. I've written about sports even. I don't want to necessarily be pigeonholed into any single category.
Yeah, and you mentioned Switzerland is one thing I've talked about in this show. Switzerland, you call it a economic distribution with defensive nation, a Swiss model for traditional conservatives, and they were proposing basically a minimum wage of 2,000 or a citizen's dividend of 2,800 U.S. dollars a month.
Yeah, and basically policies like that could only be proposed in nations like Switzerland. When you see all these American liberals who fawn over societies such as Sweden and Norway and all these welfare states saying, how come we can't be more like them? How come we can't reduce inequality like them? What I feel like a lot of people don't realize is that policies don't exist in a bubble. You have to consider the cultural context, the demographics, the size of a nation, the people's human capital. And the reason why that kind of proposal could work in a place such as Switzerland is because it's relatively homogeneous, affluent, there's a sense of common good. And a society like the United States, well, that proposal would never see the light of day because there simply isn't much of a notion of a common good anymore. And diversity has certainly played a tremendous role in that.
Yeah, and you get liberals, they will defend corporate capitalist propaganda when it comes to immigration. Like they will say immigration is good because it increases the size of the GDP.
Well, yeah, the GDP, but yet what is the benefit for the everyday person on the street? What's the benefit for various local state governments? Yeah, the federal GDP may increase, but, you know, California has been the center of illegal immigration for decades now, and it's had an abundance of low-skilled labor, and yet have housing prices declined? Has the standard of living really improved? Well, if it has, someone needs to let me know.
Yeah, I mean, you're not ready to buy a house in the Bay Area right now.
Oh, absolutely not. I have at least $800,000 more dollars to go.
Yeah. Yeah, you touched upon the manosphere. I'd like to touch on that some more. When did you discover that, and what do you see as the significance of that?
Well, I actually discovered the manosphere because someone on Robert Lindsay's blog sort of linked to Roosh V. Roosh V was kind of my introduction to the manosphere.
Yeah, I think I discovered it the same. Well, I discovered it originally. There was a site called Occidental Descent, which is Hunter Wallace's site, and then they linked to Matt Forney's old site. Do you remember Malafita?
I did not actually read that site. I wasn't really familiar with Ferdinand Bartomeu.
That's how I discovered it, yeah.
I actually got introduced to Matt Forney via alternative rights article, Planet of the Bitches, wrote for that site. And then I kind of looked at an article and said, this guy, he has some good stuff to say.
And maybe. Were you the one you mentioned you visited the Midwest and you noticed, you were talking to some girl in the Midwest and how there was such a cultural difference from California?
Yeah, I just feel like the Midwest is a little more laid back. It's not as status conscious. Now, grant you, I was in the more semi-rural and suburban parts. It wasn't really in the nightclubs downtown. But I don't know. I just feel like the culture is a little different. I feel like Californians are a little more status obsessed. And I can't help but notice that people...
So they're not. That's the thing. They're not egalitarians, I get. The right wing... The right wing's always complaining about egalitarianism, but it's not actually egalitarianism because it's a status conscious society is the opposite of egalitarianism.
Let me put it this way. Liberals in the Bay Area are egalitarian so long as there's black and brown faces. Otherwise, it can be as capitalistic or materialistic as you like, just so long as there's status-based diversity. You know, as long as there's a woman or a black person. And what I found fascinating about the Bay Area is I remember one day I was in Berkeley and I was trying to find a public restroom because, well, for obvious reasons. And what I found fascinating was that I had a tremendous difficulty finding a single public restroom. I just remember thinking to myself, you know, this is supposed to be the most liberal, egalitarian, free love hippie city. And I can't find a single public restroom anywhere in sight. And I just remember thinking, something's amiss. Perhaps they're not as egalitarian as they claim to be.
So I think, I think the alternative right should stop complaining about egalitarianism. They should just drop that term altogether.
Well, yeah, and partially, I feel like what they're not really complaining about egalitarianism per se. I mean, if you look at this Western heritage, I mean, it's rife with egalitarianism. The very foundations of the United States were egalitarian. I think what they're really reacting to are the excesses of the post-60s era, sort of going from egalitarianism to sort of this insane equalism.
But all those people, they're materialistic and they're all about status and what car you drive and where you live and what private school you send your kids to.
I don't know about the private school part, but definitely all of the above. And I pointed that out in my post, The Racial Dynamics of the Bay Area. Take the city of Palo Alto, for example. It's home to Stanford University. It's one of the most heavily democratic and progressive parts of the country. And yet it's also tremendously affluent and features one of the most opulent shopping malls in the entire region. So...
The same is true where I'm from, which is I'm from the west side of LA, so it's the same deal.
Yeah, so the contrasts are definitely there. And what I find interesting to sort of analyze and predict is that how long will society hold together if the economic prosperity and affluence continues to decline and people can no longer consume and sort of, you know, hold themselves together with purchases and material goods. Once the prosperity dries up, what will actually keep these various different groups together?
Yeah, because you have, you have these different conflicts. Like a lot of, for instance, a lot of blacks are pissed off about Mexicans coming in and taking their jobs.
Well, yeah, and that's another funny thing about these leftists when they speak of immigration. Whenever they depict resistance against mass immigration, they always tend to depict it as sort of the xenophobia of these redneck, bigoted, ignorant white people. And yet it never seems to occur to them that black people aren't exactly thrilled about having to compete with all these this army of low-skilled workers either. I mean, it's just basic economic self-interest. The more labor there is, the more competitive it is, the lower wages employers can pay. And the fact that they support mass immigration in the name of diversity, to me, is really telling.
So we were going to discuss, you were saying that you discovered the Roosh site via Robert Lindsay.
Oh yeah, Robert Lindsay's blog is a perfect place for all these random discussions, links to various sites, and I sort of stumbled upon it there, and from there I kind of discovered the Manosphere, and I feel like it sort of supplemented my overall introduction into what's known as the Dark Enlightenment. I mean, I also got introduced by some to Hartist, formerly known as Royce. I kind of got introduced to Matt Forney, saw these various other sites, and there's definitely a lot of interesting stuff. And one of the things I liked about certain Manosphere bloggers was that they weren't one-trick ponies. I mean, yeah, some of them spent a lot of time bashing feminism, but others wrote about game, others wrote about travel and lifestyle. And I feel like it's just good to have sort of this eclectic taste, one that can appeal to a wide range of people. If you just write about the same topic all the time, then eventually it's not going to resonate for much longer.
So how does something like game relate to the stuff that we're discussing throughout this interview?
Well, let me put it this way. I feel that white nationalists would do well to employ certain game principles rather than all the pessimism and gloom and doom. I feel like they should project a little more confidence, more of a winning attitude.
Because part of game, game is not about sex. Part of it is to be unapologetic.
Be unapologetic, to sort of adopt a winning pose, to unapologetically do your own thing and on your own terms. And I've actually, in many ways, been on the front lines. I mean, as you already know, my friend group is mostly non-white. And there was actually one time when we were discussing these certain controversial issues, and one of my friends asked me what my take was on affirmative action. Now, a few years ago, I might have been more timid. I might have tried to give an evasive answer like, oh, well, you know, it's mixed. But I just said that I'm opposed to it because it goes against my interests, and I do not apologize for supporting my own self-interest.
Yeah, you know, it's like Robert Lindsay had this quote. Do you know about the famous rabbi Hillel?
Oh yeah,
he has this quote. If not, you can say it. You got it perfectly.
Oh yeah, if not for myself, who am I for? And you know what I found? They actually respected me more for that. Had I been some wimpy, groveling, apologetic white person, they probably just would have kept on going. You have to lay down the line, basically establish proper boundaries. And that's how I feel like a lot of these alternative right types should conduct themselves. You know, don't be too angry or aggressive, or don't use slurs, but at the same time, hold your ground. Unapologetically say that, you know, this is our identity, this is our heritage, and we're going to protect it, we're going to support it. And I think that that's definitely how game can be applied to activism in general. But yeah, I mean, honestly, I feel like those who are paranoid about being caught in a cultural Marxist environment, I know that in the past I used to be worried about being discovered, but ultimately, most people don't really care that much about you. Now, obviously, I'll admit, when I was younger and less mature, I kind of vacillated between the two extremes, but now I'm a lot more confident about the views I hold. And honestly, the kind of views I espouse are not really that radical. I mean, which group around the world doesn't want to preserve its heritage? Which group wouldn't be opposed to some toxic trend like feminism? I mean, if you actually look at issues from more of a global context, my views are actually more of the norm. It's these radical...
Yeah, they are the extremists.
Yes, they are definitely the extremists on a global level. And I find that kind of funny because these multiculturalists are always saying that, oh, well, white people are a global minority. We're going to become a globalized world. And then I once saw some Manosphere guy tweet something that said, you know, check your white privilege. Most of the world is not white and does not condone slut culture. And I found that really funny because it's sort of actually putting the spotlight on them, saying that, no, you are the deviant ones.
Yeah, a slut culture, in a sense, is kind of a white culture. It's not going to fly in India or the Middle East.
Certainly not the Middle East. But in many ways, actually being passionate about world history and studying current events and global events has made me even more sort of secure and comfortable in my views, because I recognize that, you know, as strident and as loud as these cultural Marxists may be, they're the actual minority. And as Dota pointed out in one of his posts, all these various leftist cultural pet causes, such as feminism, multiculturalism, they're all houses of sand that require a constant upkeep. And once the upkeep fades, then it'll all come crumbling down.
And I guess to move on to a different topic is, we were talking a little bit about the Muslim issue with Dota. And Dota was originally from a Muslim background, as you know. And you have this article, Why I Repudiate American Islamophobia and Why 9/11 Doesn't Really Piss Me Off.
Oh, yeah. I know that many within the Dark Enlightenment would have my head for this, but...
But, you know what? I make an exception for the people in Europe. I think in Europe have a right to be pissed off, so I think there's a difference between the anti-Muslim activists in Europe and the ones in America. But in America, you are absolutely right.
Because, I mean, Muslims, they're not too numerous. They don't wield any political or economic power. They have no media presence. And as Stephen Snigowski in his book, The Transparent Cabal.
I've interviewed him, by the way. So if you want to go back to my Voice of Reason archive, you can look up those interviews.
Cool. But anyway, Snigowski made an interesting argument. He said that a lot of the white American hostility and rage towards Muslims was in many ways a form of displaced anger. During the 90s and the culture wars, a lot of white Americans had grievances about affirmative action, multiculturalism, mass immigration, and yet due to the prevailing norms of political correctness, they couldn't really speak out against those issues. So once 9/11 comes along and Muslims become an acceptable whipping boy, then they sort of used 9/11 as an excuse to be unapologetically patriotic again, a way to sort of get out that pent-up xenophobia. And in many ways, I see this as problematic, because Muslims are ultimately a distraction from the real problems, and those who exclusively demonize Muslims are doing a disservice to the conservative cause, I think.
Especially in America. Europe, it may be. Europe is a different case.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a different case. I mean, their Muslims are much more numerous. They have more of a presence in big cities. And in many parts of England, I've also read articles about certain Muslim sex gangs that groom white girls for sex slavery, essentially. So if you speak, going back to Matt Forney, he once wrote this very provocative article called The Case Against Female Self-Esteem. And then if you looked at Return of Kings, they ran articles such as, you know, white girls with short hair are deranged. And the articles, while provocative, are also kind of tongue-in-cheek, humorous. And if you looked at the reaction to those articles, they just provoked an enormous reaction from feminists and from the left. And that made me realize that's how you have to beat them. You have to...
Yeah, because you know what? Part of the reason Jews have been successful is because they have a lot of comedians.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even the biggest anti-Semite couldn't help but laugh at Larry David's.
You know what? Some people in my audience are going to be, but I love Larry David. I think he's hilarious.
Oh, yeah. I've seen all the episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And you know what? What I really liked about Larry David is that
he actually makes fun of, in a sense, even though he's one of them, he makes fun of all these upper class liberal West Side people who take themselves so seriously.
Oh, yeah, and they take themselves way too seriously. And the funny recurring theme of the show is that they get offended over the slightest of slights. And
one Larry David episode is he goes to a birthday party for this little girl, and he buys a doll. And he goes up and says, I got this doll, and it's a mulatto. And everyone is just all silent.
Oh, yeah, I remember the self-righteous woman there was like, it's biracial. But, yeah.
And even some of the black comedians are pretty funny. I mean, Chris Rock has his, you got your black people and you got your niggas.
Oh, yeah. I remember one of his more humorous stand-ups was when he was talking about how so many white people think that the old local black man is friendly. Like, oh, Willie, he's so sweet. And he's like, man, Willie hates your guts.
That's the thing. Jewish and black comedians, a lot of them are hilarious. You get all these regular white people, they're always worried what people think, so they end up, they're not at all funny.
And one of the white comedians I've always liked the most, for the reason that he sort of bucks this trend, is Bill Burr.
I know it. Is he the one who did the bit about he did one about the pedo hysteria?
Oh, yeah, pedophile hysteria.
That's one of Robert Lindsay's issues, the pedo hysteria.
Oh, yeah. I remember him saying, you got to move that Catch a Predator show to a black area. That's horrible PR for white people, man.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I feel like Bill Burr's a guy who, he's not too mean or degrading or offensive, but at the same time, he's sort of unapologetic. He doesn't let political correctness hinder him or constrain him. And he points out a lot of issues that people in the manosphere and even, to a smaller extent, white nationalists denounce. But he does it in such a humorous and, you know, playful way that you can't really, he doesn't really incite any strong reactions. And I think that's a valuable lesson.
What is your take on all that pedo hysteria stuff that Robert Lindsay talks about?
My take on it is that it's just a reflection of the overall neurotic culture of fear that has sort of plagued American society. In the late 90s, George Carlin even had a stand-up where he talked about people's obsessive fear of germs. You know, we need airport security everywhere. You know, boys too loud in class, better put them on Ritalin. Can't let them play dodgeball, that encourages victimization. And I feel like the United States in general has just become a much more neurotic and fearful place. You know, there's this obsession with safety. And I feel like 9/11 has only made things significantly worse. You know, now we have an extra obsession with security and safety and...
Well, the terrorism hysteria, and that goes back... I want to go back to that Islamophobia article.
Sure.
About American Islamophobia. So you basically... I mean, you think it's really ridiculous...
Oh, it's very much so ridiculous because, like I said, it ultimately distracts from far more important issues. And they're basically using Muslims as a proxy for various other grievances, which so far they've been too cowardly to address. And so I think they should address the real issues that they're griping about. And also, one thing is I've noticed is that a lot of neocon types and a lot of Zionists have also, to some extent, exploited Islamophobia to promote their wars in the Middle East. So from an America First standpoint, Islamophobia is actually sort of a disaster foreign policy-wise. And that's another thing about the views I espouse, is that we tend to adopt more of an isolationist foreign policy because not only do we not want to expend blood and treasure, but also, you know, as they say, invade the world, invite the world. If you create a globalized system, well then, diversity eventually is going to come home to you and sort of undermine your traditional society. So I feel like these foreign entanglements can only do harm in the long run.
And you mentioned Kevin MacDonald. You've written about his work.
I have every now and then, and I wrote about it in the context of sort of the origins of white guilt and why it was in the context of my article about the knockout game. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, yeah. And Fox News interviewed this one white woman who had been a victim of the knockout game, and she said that, oh, you know, I just want to make sure that they have good youth programs and, you know, investing in young people is important. And she didn't seem to care at all that she had just been randomly targeted for a violent crime. And that made me want to sort of explore the origins of white guilt a bit more. And now, I believe that Kevin MacDonald's theory is that the reason why whites tend to be so guilt-ridden and so self-flagellating compared to other groups is because of what he called altruistic punishment. And it's definitely an interesting theory, but I think one of the things that distinguishes me from most of the alternative right is that I don't really place a ton of stock in evolutionary psychology or HBD, and instead opt to look for more cultural explanations. So I actually somewhat disagreed with MacDonald there. Because if you look at the West, oh yeah, there's always been egalitarian trends present, and yet it's only really been in the past 4 decades or so that white guilt and white wimpiness insanity has really reared its head. So that suggests to me that something else is at work. But yeah, otherwise I have tremendous respect for Kevin McDonald, but I just feel that I feel like he and too many other white nationalists tend to sort of engage in HBD or evo psych reductionism. And to me, I kind of consider that a bit of a cop-out.
So what do you see as the key issues?
Well, I think that what the issue is the fundamental problem is the delegitimization of white Western identity. When leftists insist that this identity is a social construct, they're not actually trying to dispassionately observe or analyze white identity. They're trying to delegitimize it. And in reaction, a lot of white nationalists have invoked HBD and have tried to make a biological claim. But as I've said before, I think that's absolutely unnecessary. I think that you can an identity can be defended regardless of biology. And also, our blog does not endorse any views regarding biological superiority or inferiority of respective groups. However, we do believe that certain cultures are superior to others, and we do not apologize when we insist that white Western culture and civilization is indeed a class of its own. So I think that's what the fundamental issue is.
So,
civilization.
Before I wrap up the show, where do you see yourself and this blog going in the future? What are some of your future goals?
Well, I feel like this blog could definitely head in a great direction. We've only been at it for a little over 6 months, and already we've have a community of commenters. We've actually reached out to new people, new potential contributors to our blog. We might have a guest blogger. I feel like our goal is ultimately to try to spread the message, get more young people on board, and get beyond the echo chamber. And I feel like we're going to try to write about, insert a little more humor, and also to get more young people on board, to get more passionate, intellectually curious young minds on board with the agenda. And then, these young people can serve as the basis for perhaps adding a little more young passion and a little more young issues to the overall movement. Because if you do look at a lot of the alternative right, with the exception of perhaps the manosphere, it does seem disproportionately older. And I feel like that's going to have to change if the movement is to succeed. And I think, as Matt Forney even once pointed out in one of his articles, it's ultimately young men who help propel social change, because especially young men today, a lot of them have no job prospects. They're the ones with the least to lose from opposing politically correct orthodoxy. So, and I think what alternative right and white nationalist types could do is, rather than just pandering to the pessimism, is they should channel this anger into something more constructive and productive, because I think Greg Johnson was right. There definitely is a lot of potential there for recruiting young people, but I just don't feel like they've done what it takes to really appeal to them. I'd like to think that my blog sort of combines various elements, and that I don't think you could necessarily pigeonhole it as white nationalist, manosphere, or...
And I don't even
per
think
se.
The term... I don't even think that the term white nationalist is such... I don't think it's necessary to be using these terms, because it pigeonholes you.
Oh yeah, definitely. And also, as I even point out in one of my posts, contrary to the fantasies of some white nationalists, I actually sort of argue that diversity in many ways is here to stay. I mean, there's just no way that you're going to deport millions of people just like that. But I argue that rather than seeking to create a white ethnostate, white people simply just need to start asserting themselves more culturally.
Yeah, they need to learn how to thrive within this situation.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. And that's why we believe in Western character, not necessarily a white ethnostate, in the same way that we believe in a Christian identity for the West, even though we're hardly advocating any kind of theocracy. I feel like identities and cultures can thrive even if they're not the overwhelming majority. I just feel like whites need to cast off their wimpiness and all of them score zero on our test.
Yeah. All right, so Bay Area Guy, that was fantastic. Thanks again for being on.
Oh, yeah, and thanks for having me.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.